This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Are you holding on to a secret you need to get off your chest? Maybe you're feeling regret about past actions. If you keep your stressors all bottled up, it can start to affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to improve your communication skills, learn to resolve conflict, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/insighthour today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/insighthour.
After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
So death was really a big part of my experience in those years. And it was obviously very impactful, but I had such a sense of the phenomenon of life and death. Somebody is there, and then they're not there. And so that had a big impact on me. That whole experience became very vivid, you know, in my heart, in my mind.
Welcome to the Joseph Goldstein Insight Hour. This podcast is an expression of our shared interest in self-discovery. Join Joseph as he shares his deep knowledge of the path of mindfulness. If you are interested in supporting this podcast, please go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/Joseph.
Welcome, welcome to the both of you. I'm delighted to have you both here. We've been doing this podcast for many years now, but Joseph, somehow you have evaded being a guest here. It's incredible. Yes.
Waiting for the right moment.
With both of you being here together, I thought it would just be nice to take some time to really talk about kind of the source of a lot of your story, because so many of our listeners out there, you know, are students of both of yours and have read your many books and sat in many retreats with you. And I think there's something really fruitful about looking at the beginning of both of your stories and kind of what drew you into this path and when those paths crossed for the first time. And as always, just visualizing the fashion of the time. That's very good. So, Joseph, why don't we start with you? You grew up in the Catskills in New York. And yeah, tell us a little bit about what the feel of your childhood was and all of that.
Well, first, just to make a distinction between the two sides of the Catskills. So one side, like on the Woodstock side, is the big artistic communities and also some spiritual centers, Tibetan and Zen centers there. I grew up on the other side of the Catskills, which was the Jewish resort area called the Borscht Belt.
Love it.
And my family had a summer resort. So I grew up in the resort. It was just open in the summer. It was a lot of cottages. So even to go back a little before that, I'll go back pre-birth to get the story started.
Right, love it.
So what I'm told is that my mother had a really difficult pregnancy, and I had to be induced like 3 weeks or a month early because she was so sick.
Wow.
And I'm also told that I basically screamed for 3 years.
Uh-huh.
That was my entry into the world.
So soft, so gentle. Right.
I don't really remember any of that, but that's the story told anyway. But there must have been something, because up until I was about 11, I would have these periodic temper tantrums, mostly around family members, if I felt my space invaded, my emotional space. Mm-hmm. Somehow I was very sensitive to that, and kind of I would have these outbursts. Mm. And then when I was about 11 or so, I had just had one of these. And of course, it was a lot of suffering for me. It was a lot of suffering for everybody else around me. Mm-hmm. And I remember this one time, I think probably 10 or 11, just after one of these explosions, I said to myself, and this was before any knowledge of any kind of awareness, practice. Mm-hmm. But I remember telling myself, at that time I was Joey. Mm-hmm. Joey, count to 10. Mm-hmm. Just count to 10 before you explode. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing. It actually worked.
Wow.
And all of those outbursts just stopped from that time. So it's kind of interesting to me now, looking back, that somehow I even knew to think of that, to think of doing that. So maybe maybe there was some remnant from last life or something.
Yeah.
But in a way, I think it was the very first beginning of my actually looking at my mind and doing something about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I was curious to know because some children have a really rich internal life and, very imaginative. And I imagine kind of growing up where you were in nature a lot. And if that was kind of part of your experience as a kid or.
It was in an interesting way, actually, because as I said, my family had this summer resort.
Yeah.
And it was quite big. There were about 120 families, mm-hmm. Would come for the summer. But I was always delighted at Labor Day when they all left because I loved the quiet, So there was this whole resort with nobody living there except my family. Mm-hmm. And even at a young age, I just loved the quiet,
yeah.
And I would go walking in the woods and just enjoying nature. Mm. So again, it points to something that was in me, that was appreciating the quiet and the solitude.
Well, and those are two huge extremes.
Right.
To go from being smack in the middle of community and I would say a boisterous community as mm-hmm. maybe a good way to describe it.
Yes.
And then to being pretty isolated there.
Yes. Yes. And I actually enjoyed what you call isolation or solitude or quiet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really felt the peace of that, even at that young age.
Wow.
Well, I think I'll just drop in another little biographical detail.
Yeah, please.
And that is that my father died when I was 12.
Hmm.
And in looking back now, I think I really repressed dealing with it emotionally until quite a few years later.
Hmm.
But it was obviously a big change in my whole family situation. And then within a couple of years, two other close relatives also died. My grandfather and a young cousin who was killed in a car accident, who was just 19. So this was all between like 12 and, 17.
Mm-hmm.
So death was really a big part of my experience in those years.
Mm.
And it was obviously very impactful, but I had such a sense of the phenomenon mm-hmm. of life and death. Somebody is there and then they're not there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that had a big impact on me. That whole experience became very vivid, you know, in my heart, in my mind.
Well, it's interesting too, because some people can experience loss at that age and it doesn't necessarily have a big impact, and others, it will really shape the rest of your life. So did you have, aside from that awareness of just the possibility and the reality of it, what was the emotional component? Was that something you felt at that time, or was that part of what was pushed down?
It was pushed down. Yeah, for the most part, yeah, I didn't so much feel it on the emotional level at that time. It was more, it tuned into that part of my mind, which has always been, I don't know, for want of a better word, philosophical minded, you know, so it was kind of just being with the experience, as I just said, of just, okay, what is death really about? You know, so it was more on that level at that time.
Yeah.
And then it's actually interesting. It wasn't until I went into the Peace Corps and started smoking some grass in the Peace Corps for the first time. So that was my introduction.
Love it.
Introduction to that whole realm. And that's when all of this came up, you know, on a more emotional level. You know, I could feel a kind of the absence that my father's death had created. So it just took some time for me to be able, I guess, to open to that.
Do you think that you would have been interested in studying philosophy if those losses hadn't happened to you at that time?
Yeah, I do. I think that frame of mind is baked into me for whatever reason. At one point, it both became in a way, a motivating force for getting into the practice. But in my mind, at certain times, it's also a hindrance to the practice. Because one teacher once told me after a month-long retreat, you know, trying to develop more concentration, he said, "Joseph, you have too much investigation." You know, so the investigative mind is good in terms of exploring, and the wisdom aspect, out of balance, it can be a hindrance actually to the development of more stillness. But anyway, that's how my mind is. So I work with it.
Well, before we go on to your time at Columbia, Sharon, I'm curious to hear from you, because you also experienced a lot of loss at a young age, and hearing Joseph's sharing here, I'm just curious kind of if you felt any similarities with your experiences of loss and change at young ages.
Sure. I mean, I'm trying to think. Let's see. Let's calculate from 1971, which is the year I met Joseph, you know, January of 1971, there's a good many years. So, and of course, I knew his history. And so, I mean, there are many factors. You know, he's a little bit older than I am, even. So there was early loss, but there's also just the conditioning of the culture of the time. I think of Joseph's mother as an example of a woman caught in the kind of nature of the time, where it was more difficult to manifest, even if you were very bright and very accomplished and everything that meant, and, you know, what it meant to go to India at that time and kind of break free of the traditions of one's childhood and all of that. So, yeah, I think we have a lot in common in that way.
You start heading towards New York City, Joseph, and tell me what went into that calling for you.
Well, even though I enjoyed, you know, the solitude of when all the summer people left, by the end of high school, this was a very small town. You know, after the summer folks left, it was a little village of 1,000 people, and I was ready for some excitement. I remember sitting around with friends in high school, you know, Saturday night. The loop of conversation was, well, what are we going to do? And of course, there was nothing to do. So by the time I graduated, the thought of going to New York was quite exciting, and I was really happy to go to Columbia.
Yeah.
And that's really what drew me there. And I also got a big scholarship there, so that helped.
Yeah,
that huge. Helped as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then at Columbia, I was really pursuing that philosophical inclination mm-hmm. that I had. And I remember this was as a freshman in college. I don't know what prompted this questioning in my mind, but there was about a 2-week period when I was consumed with the question, does God exist? Mm-hmm. And it was really like an overarching, consuming question. It's just all I was thinking about for that short period of time. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I can't remember how I resolved it.
Yeah, what did you decide?
Right, it's kind of a shame that I can't remember. However, for some reason, the question seemed to fade away.
Yeah.
You know, but it does point to something that there was something in me that was just drawn.
Yeah.
And then as a sophomore, I was taking a course in Eastern philosophy, mm-hmm. and we were reading the Bhagavad Gita. And again, this is a time, so when I was a sophomore, that was in 1962. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about the East or Eastern philosophy or Buddhism. And I didn't know anything, you know, about any of that.
Yeah.
But we were reading the Bhagavad Gita, and there was one line in it that for some reason so completely resonated with me and was kind of out of the blue. You know, because I had no background for it at all. Mm-hmm. But the line said, act without attachment to the fruit of the action. Act without attachment to the result. Mm. And I don't know, somehow I understood it on some level, you know. And again, it's all pointing to my experience over the years of there being something in me that kept pushing me mm-hmm. towards, we could say towards the East or towards mm-hmm. the Dharma. Yeah, and so there are these little moments all along the way that kind of reveal that inner,
yeah,
that inner push.
Well, and I think that kind of inner calling or longing, there's so many different words for it, is so mysterious.
Yeah.
And I love hearing about it because it's such a kind of a universal part of being a person, whether what we're being drawn to, of course, is always so different. But, and I think for both of you, it's always really struck me that you followed that thread across the world, really, and into a totally different culture, which, you know, is a pretty big deal. And I feel like that line from the Gita is like, the essence teaching of the Gita. So it's pretty remarkable that it awakened something in you. And had you heard anything like that before? Was it, I mean,
never.
Yeah.
It was totally new.
Yeah.
Somehow the Bhagavad Gita was not in my house as I grew up.
Yeah. 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 Uh-huh. So were there any other philosophers that you felt a big connection to?
Oh, yeah. There was one big one.
Do tell.
Which also relates to my introduction to Buddhism.
Oh, good.
So when I was a junior, I took this very small seminar, small because very few people were interested in it, on the philosophy of Spinoza.
Uh-huh.
And Spinoza is not an easy read.
Yeah.
However, he's really very Buddhist. His philosophy, which I didn't know at the time, but in looking back now, I can see why I was drawn to it. Because basically, his whole philosophy mm-hmm. is non-theistic. So I got very immersed in Spinoza and studying. And then when I went into the Peace Corps and first was getting introduced to Buddhism and going to some, you know, visiting with some monks. I remember one time, the first time I went with a copy of Spinoza in hand, you know, and I was going to try to explain Spinoza to these Buddhist monks.
Love it.
But once I heard the teachings, I realized I don't really have to do this. I can just, enter into Buddha Dharma.
That's so good. And I'm curious also, just being in New York City in the 60s, if that was also impactful for you. I mean, I think going from like country to city is always a big thing, but New York was such a cultural center, especially at that time. And so I'm curious if that was part of what was happening for you, or if you were just more immersed in your studies and doing that.
Well, this was before, I mean, I graduated in January of 65. I mean, by that time, I was very anxious to get out of school and just to go and see the world, and the Peace Corps provided an opportunity to do that. But in those years, like 61 through 64, the real social activism, mm-hmm. you know, of civil rights, the movements were just beginning at that time. And so I was really not tuned into that when I was there. And so my experience of New York, other than, you know, my studies, mm-hmm. was really the cultural aspect of New York.
Yeah.
You know, of going to museums and theaters and film. And at that time, that mm-hmm. was very inspiring to me as well. It's the arts in some way touched that same place of inner exploration. Mm. You know, it was very impactful for me. Mm-hmm. In fact, for quite a while, my aspiration was really to become a film director. Uh-huh. But, you know, I just remember going, you know, in these New York art films and mm-hmm. the aesthetics of it and the beauty of it just really inspired me. And so it was more that part of being in New York. But by the time I graduated, I was definitely also ready. I just wanted to get out and see the world. And the Peace Corps was just a great opportunity for that.
I love hearing that you wanted to become a film director, because you're someone that I think of as having just an incredibly refined aesthetic, which is maybe publicly as a teacher something you're not known for as much. But everything around your space is so beautifully curated, and whether it's form or function. So I love hearing the history of that a little bit.
Right. Yeah. That part is still very important.
Yeah.
Just in my way of being. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just the aesthetic dimension mm-hmm. of life. And that's also connected not only visual, you know, but in poetry and in so many arenas, the opening that can come from that, I find really fulfilling.
Yeah, and it's interesting to hear that you could access kind of a similar place inside yourself from watching an art film as reading the Gita. It sounds like open the same door in you.
Yes.
So before we get to the next chapter of your adventure, I want to hear a little from you, Sharon, about, because at this same time, you're also in New York City. You're a few years younger than Joseph. So just a couple.
Quite a few years younger. A few years younger.
8 years younger.
Eight.
And so you're kind of having some parallel time where you're both living different lives in New York City. And
right.
Sharon, I'm hoping that you'll fill us in on your side of things.
I had a very difficult, traumatic childhood, as many people know from reading stuff I've written or listening to me talk, and with a lot of disruption and a lot of confusion. And I think, like for many people, you know, that's the case. And like for many people, it was a family where none of this was ever really spoken about that clearly. And it was only after, when I was in college, and I was seeing things with a little more clarity and a little more perspective, that I began saying, that's a weird thing, you know, like, mm-hmm. why did they say that was accidental when, you know, or that's strange. Or, and then especially it all kind of coalesced in my sophomore year in college in the Asian philosophy course that I was taking. And it was really pretty well to fulfill this philosophy requirement that I took it. And I chose that one. And in the section on Buddhism, which was really predominant in the class, hearing the Buddha talk about the suffering in life, and it was like this light went on. And I thought, oh, you know, that was, for me, a moment of complete inclusion. It wasn't a moment of it being depressing or mm-hmm. or scary. Or it was like, oh, it's not just me. You know, I belong. It's like, this is a part of life. And that was the first really important thing that happened in that class. And the second was, it was really in that context that I heard about the practices of meditation. And it was, you know, tremendous. It was like, there are practices you can do. There are methods you can undertake. And if you practice them, you'll be a lot happier. So I was going to college in Buffalo, New York, and I looked around Buffalo and I didn't see it anywhere. It was 1970 or even 69 at that point. And I created an independent study project and said, I want to go to India and study meditation. And they accepted it. So off I went.
Well, and one of the things that I've also heard you say that folks might not know is that you had the hope of maybe being a playwright at that young age.
I think when I was a child, if somebody said, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Yeah.
It was certainly a period when I said, I want to be a playwright. I must have read a book or something about somebody who was a playwright.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to be a writer of some kind. Sometimes it was a playwright, sometimes it was a journalist. Mm-hmm. I read a book on the first woman journalist. I can't remember her name. Everything was sort of in that light. I had no confidence that I could ever actually do it, but that is true.
It's interesting to me that you both had that instinct in different ways, but wanting to tell stories and really in a creative medium, and then were drawn on a path that you both write a lot and are very creative people. So I love that it found a form and that it both kind of existed in a different dream when you were younger. So I'd love to hear a little bit about, Sharon, when you talk about dreaming up going to India. I mean, that's such a huge step. And that these days it's so normal. We live in such a global world where you get on Google Maps and see what a village halfway around the world looks like. But that was really not what so many people did at that time. And yeah, what that energy was about for you to go so far and why India.
Yeah, I think I did kind of think explicitly that I would find more there. I was so ignorant, I didn't realize that India hadn't been a Buddhist country in like thousands of years, you know, but I thought I would find more, and I thought it would be really alive, and I thought I'd find a teacher. So I had a very specific kind of goal, which was to learn the practicalities of it. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really interested, you know, in the philosophy so much or in comparative religion. I really wanted to learn the how-to. And so I set out with that goal, and it's a mystery. I don't know how I ever went, you know, it was like really bizarre. And there was a wave, though. It wasn't just me. And certainly there was a movement afoot, you know, happening. And I must have heard about somebody going or a group going. There was a small group from the university going, and it was just what had to happen. And so it was step by step.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think I'd been on an airplane twice at that point, you know, once to Miami with some family and back to New York. I'd never even been to California. And so it was not just the trip in terms of flying. It was, you know, flying to Europe and then going overland to, you know, to India. And so all of a sudden everything was outrageous and completely different and scary. And then there I was in India.
Well, and also I think of that time, and I also think of a lot of the just cultural limitations that based on gender, that like, even when I was in my 20s and traveling around, I would constantly hear like, oh, it's not safe for you to travel as a woman in different parts of the world. And what were your thoughts on that?
Well, I wasn't alone for one thing. And, you know, I was with a small group of friends, and I think it wasn't safe, you know, and it just wasn't. I mean, many women did it, you know, and we're fine. But, you know, I'd never been in a culture before where a man could just like grab your body in the street, and it was normalized. And, you know, and getting to India actually felt like a big relief in a lot of ways, because it was it wasn't that, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, for a time, it's just everything was just so different. And the food and the culture and the people and mm-hmm. conversation. And but I loved India and felt like through the years since then that I had kind of erased a sort of psychological distance that I could go for 2 weeks. It would be okay because I would feel at home mm-hmm. once I got there. Mm-hmm.
Was it surprising to you to feel at home in a culture that was just so different?
Well, sure. I mean, I wasn't like, oh, thank goodness I'm home completely. I was also really scared, you know, and it was very intense. But in the process of kind of landing there, and especially once I began practicing, I really felt I could find a home there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, home is such a nuanced thing, but I have a really distinct memory of my first trip to India and walking off the plane and smelling the air. And I just felt something I'd never felt before in my life. And mm-hmm. and a feeling of home is probably the best way I could describe it. But what a kind of strange thing to have an experience like that in a place that is otherwise just so different and that it's very layered, of course.
Yeah, and it takes time.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever a point when you just thought, like, I don't like this. I want to go home.
No.
I want to go back to New York.
No.
Love that. Yeah. So why don't we loop back to you, Joseph, and kind of what brought you first to Asia and the Peace Corps and mm-hmm. and your path mm-hmm. crossing with Sharon's.
Yeah. So as I said, by the time of my junior year in college, I was ready to escape academia and, as I say, explore the world. And fortunately, that was just the year, so this was in 64, I guess, that the Peace Corps was started, maybe 63, and one of the first trainings was held at Barnard, which is part of Colombia. Mm-hmm. So I met a group of Peace Corps volunteers being trained to go overseas. And I just happened to meet them in the subway. I think I was going to see one of those art films. And we started talking, and it was meeting them and just hearing about the Peace Corps, which I really didn't know anything about. I think that provided the idea of a way to go, mm-hmm. you know, overseas. And so I got very excited by that. I actually applied to go to East Africa because I had some romantic notion mm-hmm. of, I don't know, climbing Mount Kilimanjaro or whatever. But fortunately, they sent me to Thailand instead, mm-hmm. which was very fortunate indeed, because as a Peace Corps volunteer, I was teaching English right in a school in Bangkok mm-hmm. and going to some of the discussion groups. There were some of the monks that I wanted to, as I said before, talk to about Spinoza. And, you know, so I would go to these discussion groups that were held at that time at the Marble Temple, which was just down the street from where my school was. So it's a famous temple in Thailand. There were two monks teaching Westerners. One was an English monk and one was an Indian monk, but in Bangkok. But I was still, you know, very much in my philosophical mind. Mm-hmm. And this is a story I've told very often. I would ask so many questions in these groups that people stopped coming, you know, because I was so annoying. And I think we've all been in groups like that with people like that. So one of the monks finally, out of desperation, I think, said, why don't you try meditating? And it was the first, unlike Sharon, I hadn't even really heard of meditation. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
So he just explained, you know, the basic, you know, sit down and watch your breath. So I go back, I, you know, gather some paraphernalia for sitting and whatever. And I set my alarm clock for 5 minutes because I didn't want to sit too long. But it was quite amazing because something quite important happened in those first 5 minutes. And it wasn't any great enlightenment experience, but I saw just in those few minutes that there was a way to look into the mind as well as looking out through it, mm-hmm. and that there was a methodology for doing that. Mm-hmm. And that to me was just so exciting and revelatory, and I got totally inspired by it. And I got so enthusiastic that I started inviting some of my friends over to watch me meditate. They didn't come back too often. Of course, I have since made a career of inviting people to watch me meditate and to meditate along with me. So maybe I was onto something.
That's hilarious.
But that was the beginning.
Yeah.
And it was just complete resonance from the beginning. You know, I knew that this was what I wanted to do. And yeah, when I finished the Peace Corps and came back to the States, I had had one really quite transformative experience just at the end of my Peace Corps days, mm-hmm. where somebody was reading from a Tibetan text and my mind was really concentrated and something profound opened up in listening to that particular text. So then when I went back to the States, I wanted to further explore it, but I really didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have enough experience in meditation at that point. Mm-hmm. And I realized I needed a teacher. And that's when I thought to go back to Asia to look for a teacher. And friends had been in India studying with some Tibetan teachers. So I thought, I'll stop in India. I thought I might go back to Thailand. Mm-hmm. But I stopped in India and went around to a few different places. Couldn't really connect with anybody. And here's another story just indicating there are some strange forces at work in our lives. So I was in New Delhi after having traveled around, not finding anyone that I connected with, and thought, okay, I'm going to just go back to Thailand. And I was walking to the airline office. I was in New Delhi, and I was walking to the airline office to get my ticket. And just all of a sudden, there was some force that stopped me from taking a step forward. Hmm. And this was completely unusual and out of character for me. I'm not the kind of person that has different special, you know, exotic experiences. So this just came out of the blue. Hmm. You know, I couldn't move forward. Hmm. And I had no idea what was going on. So I just turned around and went back to where I was staying. And then I had the thought, somebody had given me an acid trip. I thought, well, maybe I'll go to Benares, you know, and just take the acid on, you know, near the Ganges or something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so I couldn't go to Thailand. I couldn't make it to the airline office. Got on the train to go to Benares. And I was there for a few days. I didn't take the acid there. I'm going back to the train thinking, I'll go back to Delhi and I'll just go on to Thailand. But in the rickshaw, going to the train station, again, this thought just popped into my mind. Oh, instead of going back to Delhi, why don't you go to Bodh Gaya, which is where the Buddha was enlightened, and sit under the Bodhi tree and take the acid there? You know, I thought that would be a really great experience.
Amazing.
So instead of turning right to New Delhi, I turned left to Bodh Gaya.
Wow.
And I ended up there and looking for a place to stay, I ended up at what is called the Burmese Vihara, which was originally built for Burmese pilgrims, but Burma in those days was closed. So it was mostly where the few Westerners, and there were very few at that time, would stay in Bodh Gaya. So I went there and I met a few Danish people who were studying with Munindraji. Mm-hmm. And he was my first teacher. And so as soon as I connected with them, I went with them to meet Munindra. Mm-hmm. And it was just immediate. I knew that's exactly what I had come for. Mm. And he had said something in the very beginning that was just so seductive to me. He said, if you want to understand your mind, sit down and observe it. Mm. And that was all. You know, there was no ritual, there was no ceremony, there was nothing to join. Mm-hmm. It was just that straight, direct looking into the nature of the mind. Mm-hmm. Of course, with the instructions for how to do it. And as soon as I just heard basically the teachings of mindfulness, you know, and how to observe the mind and body, I knew I was home. It was exactly what I was looking for. And the rest is history.
It's interesting that invitation from him was so seductive for you, because I know a lot of people who would hear that and not think twice about it, or just like, oh no, that's right. I don't want to know more there.
So, or I'm more drawn maybe to the outer form of it. Mm-hmm, but yeah. Munindra was really formless in many ways.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that appealed to me. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what year was that that you met him?
That was in 1967. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was there. So I was in India for most of the next 7 years. I came back a few times to make some money, you know, and then mm-hmm. I would go back. So most of the next 7 years, with a few short intervals back in the States. Yeah, I was in India and practicing. And that's, of course, where I met Sharon in Bodh Gaya in 1970. Or 70, Sharon? Or 71?
71.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
71. So I keep hearing the phrase, the pretense of accident, that Sharon, I've heard you mention so many times, but it also kind of sounds in a way like what was at play with Joseph's process. But Sharon, will you tell us your wonderful pretense of accident story?
Sure. I was still in Buffalo, just getting ready to go. I don't know, it's maybe like 3 or 4 days before I and a small group of friends were leaving for India, and somebody arranged what I think was Trungpa Rinpoche's first North American tour, and they brought him to Buffalo, and he gave a lecture, not at the university that I was going to, but at a nearby college. And so I went, and then they asked for written questions. And so I wrote out the question basically saying, I'm leaving in a few days for India to study Buddhist meditation, and I don't know exactly where to go. Can you give me some advice? And so he had this big pile of questions in front of him, and he picked it out of the pile and read it out loud. And then he was silent for a moment. And then he said, I think you had perhaps best follow the pretense of accident. And that was it. It was like no addresses, no handy monastery guidebook. And I think you had perhaps best follow the pretense of accident. And that was it. And in fact, it kind of worked out just like that. I went to India with that very distinct yearning to learn how to do it, you know, how to have the practicalities of instruction and guidance and support in doing a practice. And I went to Dharamsala to begin with because I heard the Dalai Lama was living there and he was a Buddhist. And in fact, there were, of course, very great lamas around him and some meditation classes, but it was one of those situations where things just didn't work. Like I'd go to the meditation class and they'd say, oh, the Lama's gone to the dentist at the other end of India. He'll be back in 2 weeks, you know, things like that. The translator wasn't there. And it was actually in Dharamsala in a Tibetan restaurant that I overheard a conversation where these people were saying that there was going to be an international Hatha Yoga conference in New Delhi. And I thought, oh, you know, I'll go there and that's where I'll find the teacher. And so I went there. And that, I'm sure you've heard me say, you know, it was a really dismal experience where the low point was when these yogis and swamis were pushing and shoving against each other to be the first to grab the mic and speak. And I was just thinking, it's never going to work. And for some reason, and I just asked him, you know, why are we doing that? Dan Goleman, who at the time was a graduate student at Harvard and studying meditation as part of his psychology program, was giving a talk at that conference. And and he mentioned at the end of the talk that he was on his way to this town called Bodh Gaya, which is the town that's grown up around the descendant of the tree. They say the Buddha was sitting under when he became enlightened. And he was going to do this intensive 10-day meditation retreat, which was, and it's like he described my deepest yearning, very practical, like about how to do it. And I thought, that's it. That's what I want. And so off I went, not just me. I think, I don't know, Joseph with like 40 or 50 of us showed up. Having been inspired by Dan, who was kind of like the Pied Piper of it all.
Wow.
And there was Joseph who'd been there, what, it sounds like 3-4 years. Very peacefully.
Yes. And then the mobs came.
The mobs came. I'm curious, at that retreat, the first that you sat together, which was your first one, Sharon, and I'm curious how many Westerners it was, just kind of what that scene was like.
Maybe there was one Indian. I don't know. Like that particular time. And much later, of course, it was more a mixture of, you know, all kinds of people, but from all kinds of places. But I think it was really the massive amount of people were from the West. Mm-hmm. The Vietnam War was still going on. There were some people there who were in R&R. Mm-hmm. A lot of travelers. Goenka had just left Burma, which was very restrictive. You know, he had to get like permission to leave, sort of paperwork. And his mother was living in India and was kind of ill for a while, although she recovered. And That's how he got out. And his English was, you know, basic in some ways. I mean, we were grateful for it. But, You know, he would say things like, Ram Dass was there as a student. He would sometimes correct Goenka, who would say things like, you have to clean up your dirty mind. And he'd say, no, let's talk about purification or, you know, something else. So, but it was extraordinary. I mean, it was where I met Joseph and Krishna Das and so many of my really good friends. And we formed this kind of incredible community. It wasn't a completely silent experience. There were silent days, silent periods. And, and just the actual discovery. I think back, I'm so amused at like how thrilling it was to say, I felt this throbbing in my upper lip or something, you know, like in my breath. And it was actually thrilling. And And there was so much learning and it was kind of amazing.
One of the things that always really strikes me is that you went from like 0 to 100 because those retreats are hardcore. And I mean, our bodies are not used to doing anything for that many hours, let alone like sitting on the floor. And I feel like I've heard you say that the first time you sort of encountered Joseph was leaning on a bookshelf that was like a kind of a desperate attempt to get some back support for your very sore body. And it had like a little label on it that was like donation from Joseph Goldstein.
Yeah, it's true. We weren't allowed to sit on chairs and there were no zafus, there were no zabutons, you know, flat cushions. And We would like roll up our sleeping bags and, you know, sit on them and like, and then unroll them at night to sleep on the floor. Wow. And, well, because I was quite a bit younger then, so it was different in that way, but, and fine, but it was. No, it was very tough. And Goenka, as a kind of style of practice, doesn't have walking meditation, unlike some other schools of mindfulness. And so physically it was very hard. It was just so exhilarating.
I'm curious, because I've heard you speak, just how exhilarating it was to kind of find this thing you had been seeking. But at the same time, I imagine you were also encountering yourself in a much fuller way than you ever had. So I'm curious if you were surprised by what you found as you looked in at yourself in that way.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've told that story too, you know, and then I once marched up to Goenka and I looked at him and I said, I never used to be an angry person before I started meditating, thereby laying blame exactly where I felt it belonged, which was on him. And of course, I've been hugely angry, but I hadn't seen it. So there was a lot of that. You know, there was tremendous. It was the first time, not even just that I'd meditated, but that I practiced any real introspection. You know, I'd never been in therapy and I was young. I was 18 at this point. And, you know, it was very intense. But people asked me when I knew, like in a way, without a doubt, that there was something viable there for me, something important there for me that. And I said, from the first moment, I just knew that there's truth here and it's for me. And so everything was in that context. Plus, he was fun. You know, he was chanting, he was hanging out, answering questions. It was all, it was like a beautiful experience. It felt like a journey. You know, it was ceremonial. There was a beginning to the retreat. It was also very structured, which I realized I needed. Like one of the things about Manindra, who was also there, was that he was very unstructured. And that was something I needed much later. I needed that kind of freedom and flexibility, you know, whereas before the retreat started, we were all staying in this Burmese like temple, and somebody asked, I overheard somebody asking Manindra, saying, I want to go to town and get some chai. And town at that time was like tiny. It was like two tailor shops, I think, and the tree, of course, in the temple built behind it, and a few temples, you know, a Chinese temple and a Thai temple. And so Manindra said to him, oh, you can go to town, just go mindfully. And I thought, I had no idea what that meant. And then Goenka came along and he locked the gate, you know, so you couldn't leave. You had to climb over the gate to leave. And people would come and like sell cookies through the gate, but couldn't get out. And I realized that's what I needed in the beginning. I needed, you know, I needed the structure. I needed the security of this is how you do it. And you do just this. And later on, it was a very different story, but, you know, it was kind of a perfect scene for me in the beginning.
Well, and so remarkable that the pretense of accident, as it were, landed you in a lineage and with a teacher that you really flourished in in that way, because, you know, that is so often not the case where someone is seeking and they have to try a lot of things that don't work before they find the one that that they're going to stay with. So, And I'm curious, you know, because you spoke before about you were really drawn to the practice and less of the philosophy, less of, let's say, studying the philosophy. And I'm curious if that was something that kind of remained for a time with you, or if as you began to practice, you became more interested in those other aspects of it.
I don't know that I ever became so much interested in the philosophy. I guess you could call it that, but in part, that was studying with Sayadaw Pandita, who was a Burmese monk we brought to IMS in 1984, and even before that, certainly with Manindra. But it was partly a fascination with the language, like the word for mindfulness in Pali, the language of the original Buddhist text, is sati, and it means many different things, and exploring those different meanings, and then there's a phrase, Satipatthana. There's a famous sutta. There's a famous scripture, the Satipatthana Sutta, which has the four foundations of mindfulness. And Upandita gave, I don't know, like innumerable lectures on pa in the Satipatthana. I mean, like another night? Really? Same little, you know, two syllables? Like, really? But there's so much there. And for a while, we tried to study Pali, and it's not a living language, so the only thing you can't learn, like, I want to go buy a sandwich. It has to be like, and the Buddha entered the grove, and he said this and that. You know, and it just, what they say the Buddha said about study is that it broadens your path. And I realized, at that point, it was before Upandita, but really deepened with Upandita, that it was easy to get very attached to one's own method or feel a kind of narrowness, like it's got to be this way. And when you study more, things just broaden and you realize, oh, it's not the method, it's because the method does something, and there are probably a million other ways of doing the same thing. You know, what are they? And it just really opens up.
I'm also curious, because at that time there wasn't, you know, any kind of path outside of kind of what existed in those Eastern traditions of what practice looked like in one's life. And in those traditions, you have either renunciates who live that life full time, or householders who maybe have a practice, but there certainly were no careers as meditation teachers at that time. So did you have a sense of at all kind of where you felt meditation was going to fit in your life in that, you know, that early period of practice?
No, not exactly that, you know, because, you know, as I got more deeply into it, I kind of forgot any other life, you know. I wasn't planning on coming back to the States to live, and never imagined that I would, you know, at a certain point. And in fact, even when I came back in 1975, four, it was kind of within that idea that, oh, you know, this is for now, but I'm going to end up back in India for the rest of my life, and that's going to be it. So it sort of became the center of my life. I just didn't think it was going to be in the particular way that it ended up being.
Yeah, yeah. And so tell me, Sharon, about the first time you and Joseph connected, or that you became aware of him as more than just a name on the bookshelf, your back benefactor.
Yeah, because this was my first retreat still, and because they were not completely silent, but there were silent days. It was, I don't know what day of the retreat it was, but I was enormously frustrated with myself, and I couldn't keep my attention on the breath. Goenka starts his retreats with several days of settling your attention on the breath at the nostrils. That's his method. And then moving to what these days we tend to call a body scan. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't concentrate. And I was so distracted, and so much was coming up. And I was furious at myself. And I said something to myself. This is just before lunch, that if your mind, you know, which is how I address myself, if your mind doesn't settle down, you should just bang your head against the wall. And fortunately for me, the lunch bell rang just then. So I went down, stood on the lunch line, and there was a conversation going on behind me. And somebody said to this man, "How was your morning?" And he said, in the lightest possible tone, like totally at ease with himself, "Oh, you know, I couldn't concentrate at all, but it'll probably be better this afternoon." And I was horrified. I thought, he doesn't understand. Like, you could really get enlightened doing this stuff. Why doesn't he take it seriously? He's just like, it's just not sincere. Like, what's wrong with him? And that, of course, was Joseph. And what he was expressing was not his insincerity. It was the fact that he'd been practicing for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I'd been practicing for 4 days. And that was the difference. He had a kind of equanimity and had been through a lot more and seen things go up and down and had a lot more understanding. And so that was Joseph Goldstein.
I love that. And Joseph, I'm curious just to hear your side of it, because you had been practicing for a while, and it sounds like there was quite an influx of Westerners coming in.
Yes. So first to say, I mean, in this way, Sharon and I kind of needed different things. Mm-hmm. So when I first went, first, there were just very few people. There were, like, if there were 10 people at the Burmese Vihara, it was a lot, you know. So there was still very few people there. And Munindra, as Sharon said, he didn't teach courses. We would just sit, you know, create our own schedule, and then just go see him once a day for a kind of interview report on our meditation. And I loved that formlessness. Mm-hmm. You know, it just suited me and suited the way my mind worked. So I would just be sitting and walking at my own rhythm, and then going to see Munindra. Then it was quite a shift when Goenkaji came and all of these people came, both because of the crowds and also the much more formal structure, you know, of Goenka. But I got very connected to it when he came, and I surrendered to it. But there was one funny story with, I can't remember, Sharon, whether Ramdas was there in that first Goenka course or he came later.
He was there for my first course.
Yeah. So by this time, there were a lot of Westerners, maybe 100 or more Westerners who were coming for these retreats. And they converted an old buffalo shed on the grounds of the Vihara to make three little rooms that we could stay in. And so it turns out that I was in one end of this buffalo shed in this room, and Ramdas was in the middle, the room right next to me. And of course, I had, before he came, I had no idea who he was. I had never heard of him. He was just this guy named Ramdas. But I quickly found out that, you know, he had a big following. And so people would be coming in just all day long, you know, in between the sittings of the retreat, just talking and chatting away with Ramdas. And I'd be in my room trying to meditate and hear these new guys, you know, what are they doing? So I'd be pounding on the wall, you know, quiet in there. But again, it was another lesson in surrender, you know, and Ramdas and I ended up becoming really good friends, you know, and connected in a very deep way. Mm-hmm. But there was this transition.
Yeah.
Going from the time I had been there before all these people came into the Goenka years. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting time. And I had a very painful lesson, actually, doing the Goenka retreat. And it was a powerful lesson for me. And that was the first year, I can't remember whether it was the first year of courses or one of the subsequent years. But at a certain point in doing that practice, Sharon described as the body scan, and built on the many years of my practice there, I would just sit and I would be experiencing a body of light. There was no solidity to my body at all. And every time I would sit, it would just open to that space, and it was fantastic. I mean, it was really quite blissful. And yeah. I could sit for hours and hours and hours. There was no pain at that point. So it was really wonderful. Then the course ended, and that was a time when I had to go back to the States for some reason, maybe to make some money. I don't remember exactly. So I went back to the States, but really couldn't wait to get back to India to get back my body of light. But I went back, and for whatever reason, this body of light had become a body of twisted steel. And I was sitting, and with this body scan, it was like I was trying to push my mind through all that tension and tightness and contortion energetically in the body, you know, trying to get back some that experience which I had had. And this lasted for 2 years. And they were the worst 2 years of my practice, the most difficult. And it took me that long to realize that it wasn't about getting something. It was about opening to what was there, you know. But I was so attached to that wonderful experience that it was really subverting the deeper understanding of what meditation really is.
Yeah.
So it took me such a long time, but finally, you know, after 2 years of struggle, something released, let go, and I just settled back and opened to whatever was presenting itself. And at that point, then things began to open up a bit and flow more, you know, and the practice could move on. So even though it was a tremendously difficult and painful time, it was a huge lesson for me, you know, and has informed my practice ever since. And Munindraji had, he had a great phrase, which I must have heard thousands and thousands of times. And it really entered into me as a way of being. And he said over and over again in different contexts, be simple and easy about things. Just be simple and easy. And of course, when we are simple and easy about things, our life becomes simple and easy, you know, and that learning, you know, of going through that difficult time, I was not being simple and easy. I was struggling, fighting, wanting something to happen. And finally, when I could relax, you know, and open and become simple and easy, that's when the practice really started to flow again. Well, I'm going to jump ahead to very recent years.
Please do.
Because a phrase came to mind, which I've been using in teaching, but it really reflects the understanding that came from those years of struggle. And the phrase is, don't waste your suffering. Which means that suffering and difficulty and challenges are just a part of everybody's path. There's nobody who just, it's only bliss from beginning to end. That's not, it's not what it's about. And it's really not about bliss, even though, you know, there are some experiences of that. And by don't waste your suffering, it means the suffering itself is an experience of the first noble truth. And Saito Pandita would often comment when we'd go in for an interview, describing some difficulty, and he would say, oh, good. Now you are experiencing the truth of dukkha, mm-hmm. Of suffering. Mm-hmm. And so those experiences, as well as the pleasant ones, and perhaps even more so, can really become the field for a lot of inquiry and understanding. Mm-hmm. If there's suffering in the mind, to really look and see, okay, what is going on in the mind that's causing the suffering? Mm-hmm. So in that regard, we don't want to waste our suffering in terms of just drowning in it or being overwhelmed by it, mm-hmm. Feeling sorry for ourselves, whatever it may be. It's really taking that as a tremendous arena of learning. Mm-hmm. If we really look and investigate with interest, okay, what am I holding on to? What am I wanting? What am I pushing away? We just are exploring that. Mm-hmm. And that really is part of becoming simple and easy about things, about meditation, about our life. We just create a lot more space for the whole range of experience. So all of that was part of those years as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's quite something too that lasted so long, and that first of all, you didn't just stop or give up. I mean, and that you really stayed with the process. And so I'm curious, kind of close this loop on you and Sharon being at that Goenka retreat in January of 71. Where does that fall in of the timeline of that 2 years for you?
The 2 years was kind of in the middle of that time together. And as Sharon was overcoming her initial difficulties, she was going on to be a great yogi, one of the stars of the group.
Do tell.
Yes. Yeah. No, she was, again, she had to work through that initial stuff, but she was really an exceptional yogi, even if there was at different times, a lot of pain or suffering involved, but her practice had gotten really profound. Mm. So there was that overlap. I was struggling with my body of twisted steel and Sharon was, but we became, there was a small group of us who were there over several years. We would be in Bodh Gaya during the winter cooler months and go up to the mountains in the summer months, and rent cottages. And there was more kind of hanging out and then having periods of self-retreat, but nothing organized. There was no teacher up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were both really witness to each other's evolution on so many levels.
Yes.
Yeah.
For many years now. What's kind of interesting about Sharon and my, path over all these years is that our evolution involved sitting with the same teachers, and we had different teachers. Mm-hmm. I had started with Munindra, but then sat with Goenka, and then afterwards Sharon studied some with Goenka, and then of course our connection with Deepama, and then Upandita, and then some of our Tibetan teachers. So we've really shared that kind of evolution of our practice and teachings over all these years. Yeah, so it's a wonderful journey together.
Yeah, there's something really beautiful about that, and that there's such a kind of parallel track, but also, you're each such different people. And, just hearing that difference of, for example, like Sharon, how much structure you initially needed versus you, Joseph, who really needed a lot of
space. I love space.
And and so I think about you each kind of going through your individual process with different teachers, and that I imagine you were garnering a lot of different things and working through a lot of different material, but that it was still parallel.
Yes.
It's kind of incredible.
Yes.
Yeah. I almost want to like go through each teacher and hear a little bit, but another time.
Yeah.
Well, anything else that either of you want to add in here before we finish?
No, but I'm glad we had this conversation, because even after all these years, I learned something new about Sharon.
What was that?
That you wanted to be a playwright. I never knew that.
Well, you'll be invited to opening night. You know?
Yes, I hope so.
Amazing. Well, thank you both. And may it be the beginning of many fun conversations like this. So,
thank you.
Yeah, great.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Are you holding on to a secret you need to get off your chest? Maybe you're feeling regret about past actions. If you keep your stressors all bottled up, it can start to affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to improve your communication skills, learn to resolve conflict, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/insighthour today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/insighthour.